This is The Author's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Author's Voice, we'll hear Lauren Groff read her story, The Midnight Zone, from the May 23, 2016 issue of the magazine. Groff has been publishing fiction in The New Yorker since 2011. She's the author of one story collection and three novels, including Arcadia and Fates and Furies. Now here's Lauren Groff.
The Midnight Zone. It was an old hunting camp shipwrecked in 20 miles of scrub. Our friend had seen a Florida panther sliding through the trees there a few days earlier, but things had been fraying in our hands and the camp was free and silent, so I walked through the resistance of my cautious husband and my small boys who had wanted hermit crabs and kites and wakeboards and sand for spring break. Instead, they got ancient sinkholes filled with ferns, potential death by cat. One thing I liked was how the screens at night pulsed with the tender bellies of lizards. Even in the sleeping bag with my smaller son, the golden one, the March chill seemed to blow through my bones. I loved eating, but I'd lost so much weight by then that I carried myself delicately, as if I'd gone translucent. There was sparse electricity from a gas-powered generator and no internet, and you had to climb out through the window in the loft and stand on the roof to get a cell signal. On the third day, the boys were asleep and I dimmed the lanterns when my husband went up and out, and I heard him stepping on the metal roof, a giant brother to the raccoons that woke us thumping around up there at night like burglars. Then my husband stopped moving and stood still for so long I forgot where he was. When he came down the ladder from the loft, his face had blanched. "Who died?" I said lightly, because if anyone was going to die, it was going to be us, our skulls popping in the jaws of an endangered cat. It turned out to be a bad joke, because someone actually had died, that morning, in one of my husband's apartment buildings. A fifth-floor occupant had killed herself, maybe on purpose, with aspirin and vodka and a bathtub. Floors 4, 3, and 2 were away somewhere with beaches and alcoholic smoothies, and the first floor had discovered the problem only when the water of death had seeped into the carpet. My husband had to leave. He just fired one handyman, and the other was on his own Caribbean adventure, eating buffet food to the sound of cruise ship Calypso. "Let's pack," my husband said, but my rebelliousness at the time was like a sticky fog rolling through my body and never burning off. There was no sun inside. And so I said that the boys and I would stay. He looked at me as if I were crazy and asked how we'd manage with no car. I asked if he thought he'd married an incompetent woman, which cut to the bone because the source of our problems was that, in fact, he had. For years at a time, I was good only at the things that interested me. And since all that interested me was my work and my children, the rest of life had sort of inched away. And while it's true that my children were endlessly fascinating, two petri dishes growing human cultures, being a mother never had been, and all that seemed assigned by default of gender, I would not do because it felt insulting. I would not buy clothes. I would not make dinner. I would not keep schedules. I would not make playdates. Never, ever. Motherhood meant for me that I would take the boys on month-long adventures to Europe, teach them to blast off rockets, to swim for glory. I taught them how to read, but they could make their own lunches. I would hug them as long as they wanted to be hugged, but that was just being human. My husband had to be the one to make up for the depths of my lack. It is exhausting, living in debt that increases every day, but that you have no intention of repaying. 2 days, he promised. 2 days and he'd be back by noon on the third. He bent to kiss me, but I gave him my cheek and rolled over when the headlights blazed, then dwindled on the wall. In the banishing of the engine, the night grew bold. The wind was making a low, inhuman muttering in the pines, and, inspired, the animals let loose in call and response. Everything kept me alert until shortly before dawn, when I slept for a few minutes until the puppy whined and woke me. My older son was crying because he'd thrown off his sleeping bag in the night and was cold but too sleepy to fix the situation. I made scrambled eggs with a vengeful amount of butter and cheddar, Also, cocoa with an inch of marshmallow, thinking I would stupefy my children with calories, but the calories only made them stronger. Our friend had treated the perimeter of the clearing with panther deterrent, some sort of synthetic super predator urine, and we felt safe-ish near the cabin. We ran foot races until the dog went wild and leapt up and bit my children's arms with her puppy teeth, and the boys screamed with pain and frustration and showed me the pink stripes on their skin. I scolded the puppy harshly, and she crept off to the porch to watch us with her chin on her paws. The boys and I played soccer. We rocked in the hammock. We watched the circling red-shouldered hawks. I made my older son read Alice's Adventures in Wonderland to the little one, which was a disaster, a book so punny and Victorian for modern children. We had lunch. Then the older boy tried to make fire by rubbing sticks together, his little brother attending solemnly, and they spent the rest of the day constructing a hut out of branches. Then dinner, singing songs, a bath in the galvanized steel horse trough someone had converted to a cold water tub, picking ticks and chiggers off with tweezers, and that was it for the first day. There had been a wait on us as we played outside, not as if something were actually watching, but because of the possibility that something could be watching when we were so far from humanity in all that Florida waste. The second day should have been like the first. I doubled down on the calories, adding pancakes to breakfast, and succeeded in making the boys lie in pensive digestion out in the hammock for a little while before they ricocheted off the trees. But in the afternoon, the one light bulb sizzled out. The cabin was all dark wood, and I couldn't see the patterns on the dishes I was washing. I found a new bulb in a closet, dragged over a stool from the bar area, and made the older boy hold the spinning seat as I climbed aboard. The old bulb was hot, and I was passing it from hand to hand, holding the new bulb under my arm, when the puppy leapt up at my older son's face. He let go of the stool to whack at her, and I did a quarter spin, then fell and hit the floor with my head, and then I surely blacked out. After a while, I opened my eyes. Two children were looking down at me. They were pale and familiar. One fair, one dark, one small, one big. "Mommy," the little boy said through water. I turned my head and threw up on the floor. The bigger boy dragged a puppy who was snuffling my face out the door. I knew very little except that I was in pain and that I shouldn't move. The older boy bent over me, then lifted an intact light bulb from my armpit triumphantly. I, a chicken, the bulb, an egg. The smaller boy had a wet paper towel in his hand and he was patting my cheeks. The pulpy smell made me ill again. I closed my eyes and felt the dabbing on my forehead, on my neck, around my mouth. The small child's voice was high. He was singing a song. I started to cry with my eyes closed, and the tears went hot across my temples and into my ears. "Mommy," the older boy, the solemn dark one, screamed. And when I opened my eyes, both of the children were crying, and that was how I knew them to be mine. "Just let me rest here a minute," I said. They took my hands. I could feel the hot hands of my children, which was good. I moved my toes, then my feet. I turned my head back and forth. My neck worked, though fireworks went off in the corners of my eyes. "I can walk to town," the older boy was saying through wadding to his brother, but the nearest town was 20 miles away. Safety was 20 miles away, and there was a panther between us and there, but also possibly terrible men, sinkholes, alligators, the end of the world. There was no landline, no umbilical cord, and small boys using cell phones would easily fall off such a slick, pitched metal roof. "But what if she's all of a sudden dead and I'm all of a sudden alone?" the little boy was saying. "Okay, I'm sitting up now," I said. The puppy was howling at the door. I lifted my body onto my elbows. Gingerly, I sat. The cabin dipped and spun, and I vomited again. The big boy ran out and came back with a broom to clean up. "No," I said. "I am always too hard on him, this beautiful child who is so brilliant, who has no logic at all." "Sweetness," I said, and couldn't stop crying because I'd called him Sweetness instead of his name, which I couldn't remember just then. I took 5 or 6 deep breaths. "Thank you," I said in a calmer voice. "Just throw a whole bunch of paper towels on it and drag the rug over it to keep the dog off." The little one did so methodically, which was not his style. He has always been adept at cheerfully watching other people work for him. The bigger boy tried to get me to drink water, because this is what we do in our family in lieu of applying Band-Aids, which I refuse to buy because they are just flesh-colored landfill. Then the little boy screamed because he'd moved around me and seen the bloody back of my head, and then he dabbed at the cut with the paper towel he had previously dabbed at my pukey mouth. The paper disintegrated in his hands. He crawled into my lap and put his face on my stomach. The bigger boy held something cold on my wound, which I discovered later to be a beer can from the fridge. They were quiet like this for a very long time. The boys' names came back to me, at first dancing coyly out of reach, then, when I seized them in my hands, mine. I'd been a soccer player in high school, a speedy and aggressive midfielder, and head trauma was an old friend. I remembered this constant lability from one concussive visit to the emergency room. Confusion and the sense of doom were also familiar. I had a flash of my mother sitting beside my bed for an entire night, shaking me awake whenever I tried to fall asleep. And I now wanted my mother, not in her diminished current state, brittle retiree, but as she had been when I was young, a small person, but gigantic, a person who had blocked out the sun. I sent the little boy off to get a roll of dusty duct tape, the bigger boy to get gauze for my toiletry kit, and when they wandered back, I duct taped the gauze to my head, already mourning my long hair, which had been my most expensive pet. I inched myself across the room to the bed and climbed up, despite the sparklers behind my eyeballs. The boys let the forlorn puppy in, and when they opened the door, they also let the night in, because my fall had taken hours from our lives. It was only then, when the night entered, that I understood the depth of time we had yet to face. I had the boys bring me the lanterns, then a can opener, and the tuna, and the beans, which I opened slowly, because it is not easy supine. And we made a game out of eating, though the thought of eating anything gave me chills. The older boy brought over mason jars of milk. I let my children finish the entire half gallon of ice cream, which was my husband's, his one daily reward for being kind and good. But by this point, the man deserved our disloyalty because he was not there. It had started raining, at first a gentle thrumming on the metal roof. I tried to tell my children a cautionary tale about a little girl who fell into a well and had to wait a week until firefighters could figure out a way to rescue her. Something that maybe actually took place back in the dimness of my childhood. But the story was either too abstract for them, or I wasn't making much sense, and they didn't seem to grasp my need for them to stay in the cabin, to not go anywhere if the very worst happened. The unthinkable that I was skirting, like a pit that opened just in front of each sentence I was about to utter. They kept asking me if the girl got lots of toys when she made it out of the well. This was so against my point that I said out of spite, "Unfortunately, no, she did not." I made the boys keep me awake with stories. The younger one was into a British television show about marine life, which the older one maintained was babyish until I pretended not to believe what they were telling me. Then they both told me about cookie-cutter sharks, who bore perfect round holes in whales, as if their mouths were cookie-cutters. They told me about a fish called the Humuhumunukunukuwapua'a, a beautiful name that I couldn't say correctly, even though they sang it to me over and over, laughing to the tune of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. They told me about the walking catfish, which can stay out of water, meandering about in the mud. They told me about the sunlight, the twilight, and the midnight zones, the 3 depths of water where there is transparent light, then a murky, darkish light, then no light at all. They told me about the whirlpool, in which one current goes one way, another goes another way, and where they meet, they make a tornado of air, which stretches, my little one said, from the midnight zone where the fish are blind, all the way up, up, up to the birds. I'd begun shaking very hard, which my children, sudden gentlemen, didn't mention. They piled all the sleeping bags and blankets they could find on me, then climbed under and fell asleep without bathing or toothbrushing or getting out of their dirty clothes, which, anyway, they sweated through within an hour. The dog did not get dinner, but she didn't whine about it. And though she wasn't allowed to, she came up on the bed and slept with her head on my older son's stomach, because he was her favorite, being the biggest puppy of all. Now I had only myself to sit vigil with me, though it was still early, 9 or 10 at night. I had a European novel on the nightstand that filled me with dimness and fret, so I tried to read Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, but it was incomprehensible with my scrambled brains. Then I looked at a hunting magazine which made me remember the Florida panther. I hadn't truly forgotten about it, but could manage only a few terrors at a time, and others, when my children had been awake, were more urgent. We had seen some scat in the woods on a walk 3 days earlier. Enormous scat, either a bear's or the panther's, but certainly a giant predator's. The danger had been abstract until we saw this bodily proof of existence, and my husband and I led the children home, singing around, all four of us holding hands, and we let the dog off the leash to circle us joyously because, as small as she was, it was bred in her bones that in the face of peril she would sacrifice herself first. The rain increased until it was deafening, and still my sweaty children slept. I thought of the waves of sleep rushing through their brains, washing out the tiny, unimportant flotsam of today so that tomorrow's heavier truths could wash in. There was a nice solidity to the rain's pounding on the roof, as if the noise were a barrier that nothing could enter, a stay against the looming night. I tried to bring back the poems of my youth, but could not remember more than a few floating lines, which I put together into a strange, sad poem, Blake and Dickinson and Frost and Milton and Sexton, a tagsail poem in clammy meter that nonetheless came alive and held my hand for a little while. Then the rain diminished until all that was left were scattered clicks from the drops falling from the pines. The batteries of one lantern went out, and the light from the remaining lantern was sparse and thwarted. I could hardly see my hand or the shadow it made on the wall when I held it up. This lantern was my sister. At any moment, it too could go dark. I feasted my eyes on the cabin, which in the oncoming black had turned into a place made of gold. But the shadows seemed too thick now, fizzy at the edges, and they moved when I shifted my eyes away from them. It felt safer to look at the cheeks of my sleeping children, creamy as cheeses. It was elegiac, that last hour or so of light, and I tried to push my love for my sons into them, where their bodies were touching my own skin. The wind rose again, and it had personality. It was in a sharpish, meanish mood. It rubbed itself against the little cabin and played at the corners and broke sticks off the trees and tossed them at the roof so they jigged down like creatures with strange and scrabbling claws. The wind wrestled its endless body against the door. Everything depended on my staying still, but my skin was stuffed with itches. Something terrible in me, the darkest thing, wanted to slam my own head back against the headboard. I imagined it over and over, the sharp backward crack and the wash and spill of peace. I counted slow breaths and was not calm by 200. I counted to 1,000. The lantern flicked itself out and the dark poured in. The moon rose in the skylight and backed itself across the black. When it was gone and I was alone again, I felt the dissociation, a physical shifting, as if the best of me were detaching from my body and sitting down a few feet distant. It was a great relief. For a few moments, there was a sense of mutual watching, a wait for something definitive, though nothing definitive came, and then the bodiless me stood and circled the cabin. The dog moved and gave a soft whine through her nose, although she remained asleep. The floors were cool underfoot. My head brushed the beams, though they were 10 feet up. Where my body and those of my two sons lay together was a black and pulsing mass, a hole of light. I passed outside. The path was pale dirt and filled with sandspur, and was cold and wet after the rain. The great drops from the tree branches left a pine taste in me. The forest was not dark, because darkness has nothing to do with the forest. The forest is made of life, of light. But the trees moved with wind and subtle creatures. I wasn't in any single place. I was with the raccoons of the rooftop, who were now down fiddling with the bicycle lock on the garbage can at the end of the road, with the red-shouldered hawk chicks breathing alone in the nest, with the armadillo forcing its armored body through the brush. I hadn't realized that I'd lost my sense of smell until it returned hungrily now. I could smell the worms tracing their paths under the pine needles and the mold breathing out new spores, shaken alive by the rain. I was vigilant, moving softly in the underbrush, and the palmetto's nails scraped down my body. The cabin was not visible, but it was present, a sore at my side, a feeling of density and airlessness. I couldn't go away from it. I couldn't return. I could only circle the cabin and circle it. With each circle, a terrible, stinging anguish built in me, and I had to move faster and faster, each pass bringing up ever more wildness. What had been built to seem so solid was fragile in the face of time, because time is impassive, more animal than human. Time would not care if you fell out of it. It would continue on without you. It cannot see you. It has always been blind to the human and the things we do to stave it off, the taxonomies, the cleaning, the arranging, the ordering. Even this cabin, with its perfectly considered angles, its veins of pipes and wires, was barely more stable than the rake marks we made in the dust that morning, which time had already scrubbed away. The self in the woods ran and ran, but the running couldn't hold off the slow shift. A low mist rose from the ground and gradually came clearer. The first birds sent their questions into the chilly air. The sky developed its blue. The sun emerged. The drawing back was gradual. My older son opened his brown eyes and saw me sitting above him. "You look terrible," he said, patting my face, and my hearing was only half underwater now. My head ached, so I held my mouth shut and smiled with my eyes, and he padded off to the kitchen and came back with peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, with a set of Uno cards, with cold coffee from yesterday's pot for the low and constant thunder of my headache, with a dog whom he'd let out and then fed all by himself. I watched him. He gleamed. My little son woke but didn't get up, as if his face were attached to my shoulder by the skin. He was rubbing one unbloodied lock of my hair on his lips, the way he did after he nursed when he was a baby. My boys were not unhappy. I was usually a preoccupied mother, short with them, busy, working, until I burst into fun and then went back to my hole of work. Now I could only sit with them, talk to them. I could not even read. They were gentle with me, reminded me of a golden retriever I'd grown up with, a dog with a mouth so soft she would go down to the lake and steal ducklings and hold them intact on her tongue for hours until we noticed her sitting unusually erect in the corner, looking sly. My boys were like their father. They would one day be men who would take care of the people they loved. I closed my eyes as the boys played game after game after game of Uno. Noon arrived, noon left, and my husband did not come. At one point, something passed across the woods outside like a shudder, and a hush fell over everything. And the boys and the dog all looked at me, and their faces were like pale birds taking flight. But my hearing had mercifully shut off whatever had occasioned such swift terror over all creatures of the earth, save me. When we heard the car from afar at 4 in the afternoon, the boys jumped up. They burst out of the cabin, leaving the door wide open to the blazing light, which hurt my eyes. I heard their father's voice and then his footsteps, and he was running, and behind him the boys were running, the dog was running. Here were my husband's feet on the dirt drive. Here were his feet heavy on the porch. For a half breath, I would have vanished myself. I was everything we had fretted about, this passive queen of chaos with her bloody duct tape crown. My husband filled the door. He is a man born to fill doors. I shut my eyes. When I opened them, he was enormous above me. In his face was a thing that made me go quiet inside, made a long, slow sizzle creep up my arms from the fingertips. Because the thing I read in his face was the worst. It was fear, and it was vast. It was elemental, like the wind itself, like the cold sun I would soon feel on the silk of my pelt.
That was Lauren Groff reading her story, The Midnight Zone. Her most recent novel, Fates and Furies, was nominated for a National Book Award in 2015. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps, available from the App Store or from Google Play. If you enjoyed this program, you may also enjoy the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, which features New Yorker fiction writers reading and discussing stories from the magazine's archive. This month, Dana Spiota reads and discusses Chicken Hill by Joy Williams. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or Audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Author's Voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Author's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff and Alex Barron of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.